Before we get started, I would like to bring your attention to the next Americano Live event. The last one was a huge success, and we anticipate this one will be as big, if not bigger, to get all Trumpy about it. It's Americano Live's Trump's First 100 Days. I will be hosting it, and I will be joined by the great Lionel Shriver. We will be talking about all things Trump. There's a hell of a lot to cover, but we'll do our best to cover the lot. Do join us. It's at the Emanuel Centre on Wednesday, the 30th of April. And the discussion, according to the blurb here, the discussion starts at 7:30 p.m. Book your tickets at spectator.co.uk/Shriver, which is spelt S-H-R-I-V-E-R, as I'm sure you already knew. Please come.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light on the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
And I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor. On this week's episode, we ask, are Trump's tariffs a sign of madness or genius? Should we use the law to deter cousin marriage? And what's behind the rise in restaurant thefts?
If you don't make your product here, then you will have to pay a tariff, a very substantial tariff, when you send your product into the United States. And I say the most beautiful word in the entire dictionary of words is the word tariff. I love tariff.
Right now, China's paying a 104% tariff. Now, it sounds ridiculous, but they charged us for many items 100%, 125%. Many countries have. They've ripped us off left and right. But now it's our turn to do the ripping. That's okay.
I don't want anything to go down, but sometimes you have to take medicine to fix something.
First up, in his cover piece for The Spectator this week, our deputy editor and the editor of The Spectator's American edition, Spectator World, Freddie Gray, reflects upon the week that has seen the US president upend the global economic order. The tariffs brought in by Trump's Liberation Day have led to the biggest global market decline since the start of the COVID pandemic and have left countries scrambling for trade deals and negotiations. But, Freddie asks, could there be some method in the madness? Freddie joined the podcast along with the financial journalist and frequent Spectator contributor Matthew Lynn. Freddie, to begin with, in your piece, you call Trump's Liberation Day an orange swan event. Could you explain what you mean by that for our listeners?
Yes, well, I was very pleased that I came up with this joke myself. And then I noticed after I'd come up with it and written it that a couple of other people have done it on social media. So it's not at all original. But a black swan event, as I'm sure a lot of listeners will know, is a term coined by Nassim Nicholas Taleb in 2007. And it means a very surprising occurrence that shocks financial markets and is rationalized afterwards as something that should have been expected all along. Some people in Russia have called Trump's tariffs Liberation Day a black swan event, but I think it's probably better described as an orange swan event because it is so extraordinary and it is so baffling, and yet it was entirely predictable. Anybody who has listened to Donald Trump, particularly in the last couple of years, will know that he is dead set on imposing quite dramatic tariffs on the world, that he has been preoccupied for at least 40 years with this idea that America is being ripped off on the world stage and that trade imbalances are grossly unfair and need to be addressed. So we are now dealing in a new world where the rest of the world, apart from America, is wrestling with this orange swan. And Americans themselves are panicking because the financial universe that America itself has created appears to be suffering from a very, very profound shock. And unlike previous shocks, this one is something that the American government has quite deliberately created and is pursuing.
Matthew, you've written a piece for The Spectator looking at what might be the logic behind Trump's tariffs. What do you think the logic is behind them?
I mean, just to follow up on what Freddie was saying, I mean, it's quite hard to find the logic. You have to kind of stop and think and walk around the room with a couple of cups of coffee to try and work it out. You can come up with reasons for it. Whether they're convincing or not, we can come on to discuss in a minute, but there could be reasons for it. But the administration's been really, really bad at explaining what they're trying to do. And also the implementation has been very poor. But if you start to think about it, I mean, there is a certain logic to it. And if you try and look, you know, what they could be trying to achieve, there's a whole bunch of things. I mean, one, they could be using a battering ram to bring down tariffs and trade barriers around the world. You know, the EU, for example, has always had a 10% tariff on American cars, 2.5% on EU cars going into the United States. That wasn't really fair. You know, we ban here in the UK, we ban chlorinated chicken. Not really sure why. It's probably safer. But we just do. We basically ban American poultry from our country. And then we can sell stuff into the US. So that's not really fair. So it could be a kind of battering ram. Another big argument for them is about reindustrialization. I mean, one of the things I touched upon, which I do think is quite interesting, is that there is a sort of similarity between the Trump plan and the Biden plan. You know, Biden was all about reindustrializing and reshoring American industry and decoupling from China. Biden tried to do it with these huge subsidies, particularly for things like microchips and green energy. And Trump's trying to do it with this battering ram of tariffs. But they're both ways of getting to the same end, which is essentially decoupling from China. If you live in a world, if you decided that China is fundamentally a geopolitical adversary of the United States and of the West, then you can't be reliant upon that country for, you know, pretty much all your imports, pretty much everything you buy in Target or Walmart or Sainsbury's in the UK being manufactured in China. So you have to kind of decouple. And at the same time, you have to try and reindustrialize the American industrial base. And you know, on top of that, you know, try and reward his base. I think everyone kind of agrees, and all the social scientists and the economists have argued for a while, globalization has been great for the professional classes, for the middle classes. It's been bad for the, you know, skilled manual blue collar workers. Just listen to it. You know, any Bruce Springsteen album for the last 20 years will remind you about that. And that's Trump's base. That's the people he's trying to work for. So, you know, there are those strands of logic to it. But I do think the tariffs have been very, very badly implemented. It's been chaotic, and there's obviously been all the disruption around the market we see. But if you dig down, there is a logic that you can see to it.
Fred, can I ask you about Trump's coalition? Because in your piece, you talk about this fairly fragile coalition that exists. And we've obviously seen Elon Musk starting to take a stance against them. How serious is that for Trump? And is he going to listen to factions of his coalition?
I'm not sure it's serious as a threat for Trump, because, of course, Trump doesn't necessarily, unless he, of course, he tries to pursue a third term, which he might, he doesn't have to worry that much about re-election. And the coalition, as it stands, are bound by one thing, which is a deep loyalty, almost an obsessive loyalty, towards Trump. That said, there are very differing ways of thinking about the world within the people around Trump. You have a camp of fair traders who do accept the argument that the global economy needs to be rebalanced, who do accept that America needs reindustrialization, but they want to bring that about through reciprocity, fair tariffs between America and the rest of the world. And that seems to be what Trump wants. At the same time, you have other factions within the Trump administration who are very keen to tell Donald Trump how brave he is and how amazing he is, and how the more confusion he sows, the more it shows what a badass, brilliant leader he is. And then on top of that, you have a voting base. Several important unions have expressed their support for these tariffs. Steve Bannon, the kind of the prophet of America First, is talking gleefully about economic warfare. And those groups, they want to see this happen. They want to see the rich squeal. They want to see the elites panicking. And it's a fairly new phenomenon in American politics, particularly, and it's very new in Republican American politics. But another argument in its favor, as far as the politics is concerned, is that it continues to wrong foot the Democrats, because the Democrats have had some success, or the left of the wing of the Democratic Party, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have had some success in talking about stopping the oligarchy, by which they mean Elon Musk and the Silicon Valley billionaires who have got behind Trump. Well, what better way of stopping the oligarchy than completely tanking the global financial system? So it's a complicated mix of things going on. And but as I say at the beginning, the overriding point is that whoever you see being interviewed, they may be bickering with each other. Peter Navarro, the trade advisor, is bickering very publicly with Elon Musk. There are other clashes going on. But everyone from Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent down are quick to say this is Donald Trump's decision. The ultimate authority rests with him. There's no public break from Trump's authority at the moment.
Matthew, we're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, just after China have announced further retaliatory tariffs to 84%. By the time this podcast goes out, who knows, it may have risen even higher. Is there a risk that by starting this trade war, as Trump has done, that America's allies are pushed into further economic dependency with China?
I mean, there's definitely risks. I mean, you know, as Freddie was just touching about, I mean, there's risks all over the place. And, you know, I think one of the things that's very, you know, that is very concerning, one of the reasons the financial markets have been panicking is because, you know, as I was saying earlier, there is a kind of logic to it. And you can make an argument. But if you're going to rebase the global economy to such a huge extent, you'd kind of want the people in charge to be, you know, unified, having a thought out plan, possibly having a whiteboard somewhere of all the different steps mapped out. And instead, you know, it's complete chaos. I mean, a lot of people have been, certainly in the financial markets, have been comparing it to the Nixon shock of 1971, when Richard Nixon came off the gold standard, ripped up the Bretton Woods Agreement, and basically threw the kind of financial system into chaos. But the Nixon administration, you know, wasn't the nicest bunch of people in the world, but they were well organized and they knew what they were doing and they were disciplined. So I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the risk of retaliation is very high. You know, you got 104% on Chinese stuff going to the United States. Now 84% on American stuff going into China. That's the two biggest economies in the world, sort of roughly doubling the price levels of everything. You know, it's chaotic. You know, how that's going to play out, I don't think anyone knows. But I mean, you know, on the surface, you're going to get a very steep inflationary shock in both countries and potentially a recession in both countries. And I do think that's the big downside, although you can see a logic to it. It's the big downside of the Trump plan, if we can dignify it with that word, is that it's not well organized and it's not well planned. I mean, it would have been far better, for example, if you want to have these tariffs, to announce them 6 months in advance and to phase them in stages. You know, even Brexit looks well organized in comparison to this. So yeah, there are big risks on both sides.
Matthew, on the point about Brexit, of course, Britain received different tariffs to the EU. EU received 20% from the White House, whereas UK only 10%. Is that a success for Starmer?
It is a success. And you know, it's a benefit of Brexit. I mean, you know, you can argue that he might have done it anyway, but if we were still part of the EU, and definitely if we were part of the customs union, as the kind of Remainers and the Lib Dems keep telling us, we'd be much better off with the customs union. There would have been some legal technicality that Trump wouldn't have put the same tariffs on us. But I think all the evidence is that Trump doesn't care about legal niceties. He's a broad brush kind of a guy. And we would have almost certainly had 20%. And also, even worse, you know, the EU is going to retaliate. And what we've seen in the China situation, as soon as you retaliate, you know, Trump hates people retaliating against him. He just slaps a bigger tariff on you. So the EU, by the time people are listening to this, and certainly by the end of the week, the EU could be on 50%, 60% on German cars and French wine going into the United States. So, you know, it's lucky for us. We certainly didn't plan it that way because we weren't looking at this kind of a world. But it's lucky for us that we happen to be outside of that mess. And you know, hopefully we can just stick with 10%, which will give the UK some reprieve and will allow make things slightly better for British businesses.
And Fred, just finally, do you think the lesson from all of this, as we move further into the era of Trump 2.0, is to take Trump seriously when he says he's going to do these things?
Well, yes, perhaps take him seriously and literally a bit more. The only sort of explanation that at the moment I think is making sense is that this is really all about China, which we're seeing last night and today, and that trade policy is crossing over into national security policy, and America is trying to combat the rise of China, the rise of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, by saying to the rest of the world, you can either choose between a reciprocal free trade world with us, or we're going to blow up the whole global system. And, you know, it's very true to say that, you know, Biden had been doing a lot of this. Trump, one, did some of it too, did quite a lot of it too. And even Obama was moving in that direction. But I think the feeling among Trumpists is that it was going far too slowly. And COVID, the COVID crisis, showed that America is extremely vulnerable, that supply chains are extremely vulnerable, and that critical national security manufacturing is extremely vulnerable. And so it feels an urgent need to take on China now, and it's willing to do it. And if that means creating a recession, so be it.
On that cheery note, Freddie and Matthew, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Laura, what else did you enjoy in the magazine this week?
Well, I'm going to go for Ross Clark, writing about whether green activists are driving themselves to extinction. Ross has been looking at some of the birth rates in cities like Bristol and Cambridge, where it seems that anti-natalist policies are alive and well. And he says that while some on the extreme fringes of the green movement might welcome a complete collapse of birth, he also says that more moderate greens should be careful what they wish for, because they may well be driving their own movement to extinction. Will, what did you enjoy?
I particularly loved this week's diary, which was written by Petroc Trelawney, the Radio 3 presenter. And he writes an extremely moving diary about giving up Radio 3's breakfast programme slot after 14 years at the helm. He has been kind enough to record an out loud version of his diary, which we can listen to now.
Bach Before 7 has become the way many Radio 3 listeners start their day. In the few times when I've mischievously suggested we might rest the feature, our inbox has overflowed, with 99% of respondents demanding its survival. Salford colleagues assure me that it is safe. Over the years, we have thoroughly mined the rich stock of sacred cantatas Bach wrote for the Thomaskirche in Leipzig. The secular cantatas are also well worth listening to. Some are comic, such as the Coffee Cantata. Others celebratory, written for court feasts at Weimar or Curtin, or royal birthdays amongst the Prince Electoral family of Saxony. Producer Susan Kenyon found a brilliant one for my final morning programme, the Cantata No. 71, written for a new town council in Mulhausen, where Bach worked when he was in his early 20s. It includes the chorus, "Crown the new regime in every way, crown with blessing." It was the perfect sentiment as I handed breakfast on to Tom. And how splendid that the great Johann Sebastian Bach found inspiration not just from his faith and his princely patrons, but also from a local government election in early 18th century Germany.
Next up, in the magazine this week, the journalist Iram Ramzan provides her notes on cousin marriages, explaining that despite being taboo in the UK, it was to her absolute horror when her family suggested she marry her cousin. The topic has also been in the news recently because the Conservative MP Richard Holden has proposed banning the practice of cousin marriage. But should the law really ban cousin marriage because of cultural and ethical considerations, as well as medical ones? And what exactly is the genetic risk? Iram joined the podcast to discuss alongside Dominic Wilkinson, Professor of Medical Ethics at the University of Oxford. I started by asking Iram to talk us through her own personal experience.
Yes, so I talk about how when I was around 19 or 20 years old, I was still studying, and my mum sat me down and she told me that it was my grandma's dying wish that I marry her nephew back in her village. And so we're from Pakistan administered Kashmir. And he was, I'd say he was significantly older. I'm not exactly sure what the age gap was, but he was older. And, you know, we had met whenever I had gone back to the village, and we'd only exchanged pleasantries. So it's not like I had a, you know, detailed conversation with him. And I just remember thinking, why on earth would I want to marry this guy? We've got nothing in common, different backgrounds, different cultures. He didn't even speak English. you know, I was at university, so more educated, and thought this is just such a mismatch. I was quite surprised to be asked about it. I mean, it wasn't a complete surprise because, you know, cousin marriages have been the norm in my family and in other Pakistani families as well. But I just thought, given that I was at university and, you know, a bit more educated and had more ambitions, that, you know, maybe they wouldn't ask me to consider something like this.
And you say in the piece that you said no. How did that go down?
I don't want to go into too many details there, but it was met with some hostility, really. And yeah, that it just went down like a lead balloon, really. But nobody really asked me to marry a cousin again. Although in the piece I do highlight that my auntie, my mum's sister, did express me wanting to marry her son once. And he's 5 years younger. And, you know, I just remember babysitting him as well. I just thought the whole thing was, I just thought, seriously, is this a joke? Like, how could you even entertain this idea? And he quite rightly found it just repulsive as well. And he just kept saying, when I told him. And I was slightly offended because I thought, I mean, I'm a cat, really. but, you know, I thought, actually, thinking of it logically, I can see why he would object.
And you said that just now, and you say in the piece as well, that the cousin marriage is quite normal in Pakistan. And I wondered, to what extent is it also normal in Pakistani British communities?
In Pakistan, it's just over 60% of marriages are consanguineous, so between cousins, or maybe including second cousins. And in Britain, so the Seminole Born in Bradford research found that around 62% of marriages were between cousins. That was over a decade ago. And when I researched on this story, the project found that actually the rates have now fallen to about 46%. So it's still high, but it has gone in the right direction.
Hmm. And Dominic, I'd like to bring you into the conversation, if I may. There's been a lot of talk in British politics recently about cousin marriage. There was even talk in the Commons about whether it should be banned or not. And there's quite a lot that's said about the genetic risks of marriage between cousins. How great do you think that medical risk is?
When you think about the genetic risk, it's important to put it in context. And it sounds smaller or greater depending on how you express it. So one way of expressing it that sounds dramatic is to say that the risk is doubled of genetic problems in couples who are first cousins, the risk of one of their children. But a different way of saying it is to observe that 6% of children from parents who are first cousins have genetic or chromosomal problems. So to put it another way, 94% don't. Again, just to put it in context, there's a 3% risk for those of us who aren't related to our partners of having genetic or chromosomal problems. So the risk is increased, but actually more than 9 out of 10 children born to first cousin parents won't have genetic or congenital problems.
Hiram, you also make the interesting point in your piece that whilst presumably lots of people in this country might think it is illegal to marry your cousin, it's not. And actually, it's kind of been a long-standing tradition, particularly within the royal family and the aristocracy. What do you discern from that?
It was not unusual to hear of cousin marriages all those years ago, particularly in the royal family. But I think in British Pakistani communities, while I pointed out that the rate has fallen, I would say it's still happens. What we need to point out is that it's not just one-off cousin marriages that are happening, it's generation after generation after generation. And that's what the Born in Bradford research was showing, that the children born to these parents were cousins. But you have to look at the bigger picture here. Yes, they are cousins, but were their grandparents cousins as well? Were their great-grandparents cousins as well? So it's not a case of just these one-off cousins marrying. It's multi-generational, and that's where the bigger problems lie.
Dominic, I'd love to know your opinion about that. Is the problem worsening, perhaps, over time if cousins will marry cousins will marry cousins?
So the risks for genetic problems do increase where parents are connected. And the reason is because of a particular type of genetic problem, what's called a recessive genetic problem, where both parents carry a genetic mistake, but carry if they carry the same genetic mistake, then their children can have a condition. And it's within communities where there's lots of connections, lots of individuals are related, or with particularly very small communities, you have higher rates of these types of recessive illness.
And as a professor of medical ethics, what ethical concerns do you have around banning the practice?
When we're thinking about the law, what we're talking about is what are the reasons for doing for having such a law, and then what might be the reasons against it? What are the considerations? So the concern is particularly about the rate of genetic illness in children. If you're proposing to make a law that would stop people from marrying, having children together, that's interfering with a pretty basic freedom, which is a freedom for people to choose who they partner up with, choose who they have children with. To put it in context, we don't say, for example, that those who have a disability or an illness where they have a 1 in 4 chance that their children will have a genetic problem, for example, where they've already had children with genetic illness, or where they themselves carry a genetic disease and perhaps 1 in 2 of their children, we wouldn't say you can't have children, because of course we'd say, look, that would be utterly unfair. So for couples who have a 1 in 20 chance of having genetic problems in their children, for society to say, not only do we think this is a bad idea, but we're not going to allow you, is to take a pretty big step.
And so would you extend that freedom in all cases? I mean, if you want to get to a kind of more extreme example, I suppose, what about brothers marrying sisters and so on?
So I think that it's very interesting to think about where we draw these lines, and that there isn't any non-arbitrary way of drawing it. I think the if we say first cousins are not allowed, then we're saying that this type of risk of problems in children is too high. And of course, as I mentioned, that might have implications for other types of parents who have much higher rates of genetic problems. What one thing that's important to recognize is that these laws are not for the sake of those children. These children, if we pass these laws, will never exist. So they won't be protected from anything. Those children won't exist. And laws that are designed to improve the health of the genetic health of the population or of the next generation, perhaps for the sake of the public health budget, by telling people who can marry, who can have children, those laws in a different era we would have called eugenic. I think we need to think carefully about what we're saying when we make laws that tell people who can reproduce because we're worried about genetic illness. And we need to decide where we draw that line.
Aram, just finally, can I ask you, but beyond the kind of genetic questions, from your own knowledge of cousin marriages within family or friends, do you think that they make for particularly solid, happy marriages? I mean, what's your experience of that side of things?
Generally, no. And I know when this was discussed in Parliament, the MP, I think it was Iqbal Muhammad from Dewsbury, said that it's one way of strengthening family ties. But I would argue, well, you're already, you know, related genetically. How you have DNA in common, how much closer do you want to be? And also, when you have relatives marry, like cousins marrying, it actually puts more strain on the family. So if there's an argument, if they're going to split up, it does have an impact on wider families, which, you know, I've witnessed myself. I do agree to an extent with Dominic about the idea of telling people who they can and can't marry, you know, it's not good on libertarian grounds. And I don't like the idea of telling people who they can and can't marry as well. But when it has an impact like this, I also talk about in my piece that a lot of the young girls and boys that I went to school with, they didn't really have much of a choice in who to get married to. And they would often be married off to a relative back in Pakistan or maybe Bangladesh. And I just wonder if that if a ban had been in place, then what the impact would have been. Would they have been allowed to marry someone of their own choice or not? And probably would have had a greater choice and maybe had happier lives as a result.
Aram and Dominic, thank you very much for joining us.
And finally, why are British restaurants suffering from a rise in theft? In the magazine this week, The Spectator's food columnist and co-host of our Table Talk podcast, Olivia Potts, writes about how restaurant theft is out of control. Gordon Ramsay's latest restaurant, for example, suffered a £2,000 loss in 1 week from theft. Surprisingly, as many as 17 million people say they have stolen from a pub or a restaurant. Why do they do it? And why is restaurant theft in particular a problem now? Liv joined us to discuss further, alongside someone who agreed to share their own experience of stealing from restaurants as long as we would keep his identity secret. We have changed his name and scrambled his voice to protect his identity. So for the purposes of this podcast, let's call him Leo Lightfinger. I started by asking Liv just how bad a problem this is for restaurants now.
Well, it's one of those problems that if you look at the individual items, really doesn't look like a big deal. You know, we're talking about people potentially taking a brightly coloured spoon, or what's brought up in the news recently is Gordon Ramsay talking about little model cats in his Lucky Cat restaurant. But the problem is with anything like this, once they're taken at large numbers, the costs start rising. And we're looking at an industry which is already struggling in its profit margins. And those costs mount up. So what can seem like an innocent little jape amongst friends can cause real losses to the restaurants.
What do you think is going on here, I suppose, almost psychologically? Because as you say in the piece, a lot of the things being stolen, they're from some often quite respectable restaurants and they're taken by very respectable people. Why is it that this is a type of theft that people don't quite see as theft, if you see what I mean?
I think it's a tricky one. I think most of the items that are taken, you're not seeing the price on them. So it's not like you're walking down a supermarket aisle and deciding to nick something that costs a tenner and there's a little price tag on the side of it. They're often things that are quite personal to the restaurants. So there's a sort of souvenir or trophy quality to the taking of them. And, you know, it's also, it's one of those slight wager things, isn't it? Like it's showboating, I think, to a certain extent. Can you get away with taking this thing? But because the price isn't there, because it's not, you know, a friend's home, there isn't the same sort of moral responsibility. And often we're talking about eating out where alcohol is involved and people perhaps lose their better judgment a little bit.
Leo, I believe that you have taken some things from restaurants before, which is why you're joining us today. Could you start by giving a few examples of what you've pinched?
Well, I've only ever taken napkins because I think, in my mind, napkins are kind of quite small fry. From the Ivy, which I live reasonably close to, and then also Zadel, which is mentioned in the piece, I think, as Liv says, it does tend to be showboating a little bit and also not taken particularly seriously. I suppose one thing I would say is when you've just shelled out 250 quid for a dinner, you feel slightly as though a napkin that probably costs no more than £3 to the restaurant is sort of fair game.
What wouldn't be fair game? Where do you think there's the line, if there is a line?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't try and steal a table and chairs. I don't know. I'm not sure where the line is. So my sister stole one of the famous butter dishes from Bibendum that is also mentioned in the piece. And when I was a kid, my mum stole a coffee cup from Pizza Express, which is actually a lovely coffee cup. So nice, in fact, that I went onto eBay a few years ago and looked them up again. I managed to get six for about £20 or £30, which I'm sure the person selling them, you know, had access to through entirely legitimate means.
Liv, is this a problem that is growing now then? As Leo just said, a lot of people might see the odd item here and there as almost part of the price of an expensive meal. So given that eating out is so much more expensive now, is this a problem that's only going to get worse?
I mean, I can't see it getting better for that reason, because I think we are spending more per meal, and possibly they're therefore becoming rarer. I mean, one of the things that might cause the thefts to go down slightly is that during their heyday, people were really taking ashtrays. And obviously now that we don't smoke in restaurants, that's a significantly smaller problem. But, you know, napkins, tableware, really, you know, nice knives. I think I write about flat irons, very distinctive little cleavers. There is a vogue for having really distinctive items on the tables. And that does appear to be catnip to the restaurant thieves. So I don't see it becoming markedly better anytime soon.
Leo, can I ask you what you do with your items? Do you sit down with your Brasserie Zidane napkin and your Pizza Express cup and have a meal, or do you keep them in a cupboard as a trophy?
Well, I mean, I only have these napkins, which I use as tea towels. They're very good tea towels. The cups, yeah, I drink coffee out of them, obviously. I mean, those were acquired by me through kind of legitimate means, I think. But no, I mean, we also have a tramp ashtray from the 80s that my mum stole, which is a prized family heirloom now. And I'm sure if, you know, we went back to tramp and mentioned it, they wouldn't mind all that much. I hope not.
So do you feel any guilt?
I mean, I felt a little bit of guilt after reading Liv's piece. I went and looked at the average profit margin for a restaurant and saw that it was somewhere between 3 and 5%. So even if you're looking at like a £250 dinner, that's, I mean, can't do the maths in my head, but it's really not very much money. And like I said, if a napkin does only cost £3, that's actually not an insubstantial amount of money to the restaurant. I know Zidell, as Liv mentioned in the piece, now sells them on their website, and I think I probably would consider buying a... Although it's just not as fun, is it?
Well, Liv, I was going to ask you about this, because you finish your piece by saying one of the ways that restaurants deal with this is by selling the items, and it's partly because people feel a bit bad then, because it's actually got a price on it, but also there's a kind of inherent snobbery in it, that actually if you can buy it, anyone can buy it. Do you think more restaurants will be starting to sell their items as a way of getting around theft?
Well, it's certainly becoming more of a thing. It's possibly becoming more of a thing because, you know, online purchasing on websites is just, you know, very everyday now. It doesn't take very much work for them to do. But certainly it removes the cachet of you could only own this item if you've been to this very specific restaurant for a very expensive meal. Or not, you know, not terribly. We're not talking solely about very high cost meals, but you wouldn't have had to have visited the restaurant. Therefore, yes, a trophy isn't a trophy if you've bought it, is it? Or if you could have bought it, crucially. So I think maybe our inherent snobbery is the only answer to bringing down the high time of restaurant thefts. And then, yeah, perhaps nobody will want these gorgeous Brasserie Zidane napkins or very swanky butter dishes, and we'll all just go back to our purchasing our own stuff. But I don't know, I fear that the magic of the moment in a restaurant and the opportunistic nature of it, there'll always be some people that really appeals to.
Leo, just finally, you said just now that you felt a little bit of guilt after reading Liv's piece. Are you going to leave behind your life of crime?
I mean, sat here in the lovely Salubrious Spectator offices, I'll say yes, and then a bottle and a half of wine down and having just forked out £300, I think probably not.
Leo and Liv, thank you very much for joining. And that's everything this week. As ever, if you pick up a copy of the magazine, you can read everything that we've talked about. And if you do enjoy listening to the podcast, please do click the follow button. You'll then be notified when a new episode is out. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm William Moore. And we hope you'll join us again next week.